From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 345, recorded live Thursday, November 8th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at TELERIK.com. And by Franklins.net, training developers to work smarter. And now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Microsoft employee and world-class climber, Audrey Snezek.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Audrey Snezek, who is a program manager on the Azure team working in compute. But that's not why I called you, Audrey. You have a really cool hobby.
Yes, I do.
Would you call it a hobby or would you call it a life obsession that you would rather be doing than working?
I think it's of it more of a life obsession.
What do you do that you're world class at? Tell me.
I'm a rock climber.
Talk to me about rock climbing. There's different kinds. There's like bouldering and there's rock climbing without a rope and with a rope. And there's various kinds of rock climbing. We know nothing about this, so break it down for me.
Yeah, there are different kinds of rock climbing. There's a lot of times when I tell people that I rock climb, they think of Mount Rainier or these big peaks. And that is definitely a type of climbing, but it's not rock climbing. Rock climbing actually has different facets within it as well. There's bouldering, as you mentioned, where you climb smaller rocks, and you have these crash pads to catch you so you don't have a rope attached to you, and you have a group of people usually huddled around to keep you from hitting objects if you fall to the ground. Mm-hmm. And then you have these big walls that are rock cliffs that you might see around cliff bands that are around the mountains or even up in the mountains. And within that, you have people who hike very long distances to get to these peaks to climb them. And then you have something more like what I do, which is I go out to maybe smaller approaches within the 30-minute, 40-minute range, not too high elevation gain, but you approach these rock walls, and then they are about several hundred feet maybe of varying heights. And I scale those, and they range in difficulty, from scrambling to very technical, could be very steep. The angles of the rock are multifaceted, and that's what I like to do, is really go for difficulty, go for the hardest kind of lines in that space.
So you said 30 to 40-minute range. Is that the distance that you're driving or the time it takes for you to do the rock?
Just the time that I'm hiking. Some hikes are 5 minutes, some are 2 minutes, some are 30 minutes, 40 minutes. Generally, if you're hiking for miles to get to a wall, that's more of an epic journey. I tend not to do those. Those are more like alpine approaches.
Why does the hike to the rock matter? Is that just whether or not you have energy when you get there?
Some of it is about that. Some of it is that the gear required to do a climb in that region, you have to haul a rope and sometimes the equipment that you want to attach yourself to the rock, other kinds of supplies, food, harness, belay devices, warm clothes, things like that tend to weigh a bit more and can make those hikes rather laborious.
Mm-hmm. Now I've got little kids and they are always looking for new stuff to do. And I'm hoping that at some point in their life, they're going to discover that thing that they want to do exclusively. You know, and if that thing makes the money, great. And if it doesn't make the money, great. Maybe it's Legos or maybe it's making movies, but they haven't discovered it yet because they're little kids. When did you discover that this was the thing? I mean, there must have been lots of things you must have tried growing up, but then you found this.
Yeah, I didn't try too many things growing up, actually. I'm very athletic. I've always been drawn to sports. I didn't play a lot of sports growing up. I did run track and cross country in high school, and I've continued to run. I love running, but I've never done marathon type runs. These are really mid-distance 5-10K max. I don't aspire to anything longer. But rock climbing came to me in university. Some friends had discovered it, wanted to introduce me to it, took me out to it, and I just fell in love with it. I was pretty adept at it quickly. I was convinced I wanted to do it all the time. And the setting with which I started was serene and calm and peaceful for me. So climbing became a place of serenity, and the challenge gave me a bit of drive and motivation to keep at it. But it was enough for me to feel like it was an escape from normal life. It was something that provided great satisfaction for me that really drove me to go do it more and more.
Do you remember, like, the drive there? Were you thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to totally be awesome? Like, do you remember the drive to your first rock climbing experience?
Yeah, it was only 5 minutes away from the university, so it really wasn't very far. And we were coming up to it, and it's this little, it would be like a creek, and you would just hike down. You park at the top, and so you don't see the cliff right away. And you hike down, and you're in this kind of a stream system. And there's this water flowing. You could hear it bubbling over a little bit. And then you walk around this corner on this small dirt path, and there's this little wall. It was really tiny, really, compared to the walls I climbed today. And it was just beautiful. And they, you know, I looked at the rock and was like, we're going to climb this? And then they started to show me, this is a route, and this is a problem, and you go up here is something. And as I started to find the different lines that people were drawn to on the rock, I started to see opportunity, and it was just a really, really neat place to go. It's very isolated and in the middle of the city. It was great.
And how long ago was that?
That was 20 years ago. I'm celebrating my 20 years of climbing this year.
Wow. Okay. So I looked around on the web, and as I'm searching around for some of your adventures and pictures of you climbing rocks, I see these numbers. They're saying, well, here she is climbing a 5.14, and here she is climbing at this point. That, what does that number mean?
The numbers, in fact, the 5.14, we call it 5.14. It's a great, no worries. It's a grading system that we use here, and that is the Yosemite system. The Americas pretty much follow that. The Europeans have a different system. Australians have a different system. So there's multiple ways to grade the difficulty of a climb. And in our system, a scramble where you might need to tie in with ropes might start around a 5.5, so 5.5 grade. And then you would grade the difficulty by number from there. So you might have a 5.5, a 5.6, a 5.7, a 5.8. And these are really the easier set of climbs. And as they go up, they become gradually more difficult. And when you hit that 5.10 space, for some reason we decided between 5.10 and 5.11 that we could be more granular in the difficulty. So now you get 5.10 A, B, C, D, and then you'll have 5.11. So there's four grades within each number after that. And once you hit 5.14, we now have something that's called a 5.15, a 5.15 A, a 5.15 B, maybe the potential for a 5.15 C. Those are the cutting edge difficulty lines that are being established today, and there are only a few of those in the world, and only a very, very few people who can climb at that level. So down from there, you can see that if you get up to that difficulty marking, you're pretty much at the echelon group of people who can climb at that grade.
Mm-hmm. And what does the five mean? If easy starts at five something, then there's no fours or threes. Walking around to the mall is a three.
Actually,
for me.
That's right. It actually does go something like that. And there's a whole, that scale is more in the mountaineering book that outlines, like, you know, why it starts at five or whatever. It seems silly. It seems kind of random, but that's how we do it.
Okay. So then if I understand what you just said, then 5.14 would be non-trivial for anyone.
That's right. 5.14 is a highly sought after grade for everyone in climbing, if you're driven for that.
Mm-hmm. But you were climbing that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even more.
Actually, no. I came at rock climbing very much like the average person, very recreationally, for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And I was climbing hard 5.11 for the duration of that time period, until I decided that I thought I could do more and wanted to try to attain a 5.14 grade one day. So I've only just done my first two 5.14s this year.
Oh, wow. Okay. And is this common for women? Is there a, like, what is, how does it break down on the gender lines? Like, men have upper body strength, but women have legs. And I understand that leg strength is super important for climbing.
Leg strength can translate into technique, is what we call it. And it's definitely true that men tend to come at it in a more powerful, brute force way, and women tend to come at it from a more technical aspect. It's not universally true, but it's generally true. And I think, you know, women, or in my case for sure, I work really hard at trying to develop power and become a more powerful climber. And I know that there are some very strong men out there who they focus a lot on their technique, trying to become a more technical climber. And the balance of that really, really can improve your climbing potential. That doesn't mean that you can't be a 514 climber and just be powerful or just be technical with some power. I think it's all very individual.
I would think, and I'm not a climber. I've taken the kids bouldering like at a club once and they thought it was fun. But as an engineer type person, I am immediately starting to try to solve this in my head. And I'm thinking to myself that the amount of power that you could produce as it relates to your weight, if you could remain small and thin and light, but have a lot of power in your arms and legs, that would be good. So if you gained 10 pounds of muscle, that might be good, but then you got to carry around 10 pounds of muscle. Do you think about things like that?
I do. I think about that a lot. I think a lot of climbers think about that, especially when you're trying to do the more difficult routes. I think as an athlete, in any trade, when you're obsessed at that level, it's somewhere along the line you start to think about your weight, strength to weight ratio.
And how does that work for you? I mean, I assume you can do a lot of pull-ups.
No, actually, I can't. I don't train a lot of pull-ups. I do a fair number, and I've certainly done some training with pull-ups over the years, but I don't do a lot of them. I do focus a lot on training for power, and that might include some pull-type exercises. And I think it's a combination of the core balance and strength with some lean, leaning out so that you're not too muscular, but you have some muscle. You train fast twitch so you can react and be powerful. And you don't want to bulk up, and you don't want to be too lean so you can't tap into that power because you're too hungry and starved. So you have no energy to, you know, supply that. So it seems like for me, it's just it's a balancing game. There are definitely, times when I'm focused more on building power and not worrying about whether I build muscle mass and trying to be strong. And then there are definitely times when I'm worried about, can I be leaner and increasing my cardio to try to improve that aspect? And maybe that's targeting a specific time for climbing outside, or maybe it's a specific competition. But I certainly appreciate moments when I can be more carefree and just climb for fun and not think about what I'm eating or not eating and worrying about whether I'm training or not training, to give myself that little break and then pick it up in times when I'm ready to drive again.
Well, that's interesting, because that makes me realize that I'm learning about this, or I'm trying to analyze it in my head, but that does kind of take away the pure joy of climbing. But there is the need to do both. If you want to climb at the level of 514, you can't just roll up and start climbing to pull something like that off, right?
I'd like to think so. But I do know there are some very strong people, very talented people out there, who maybe are a bit of an anomaly in that way, and are climbing super strong at these grades without, I don't know, many years or maybe no training.
Hey, this is Scott, and I am really excited about these guys. This is a special offer from our friends at DN Simple. True story, Carl reached out to DN Simple to ask them if they wanted to advertise with Hansel Minutes, because we like them that much. It was a kind of a funny thing. They didn't come to us. We went to them because we think DN Simple is great. It's a hosted DNS service that you use to manage your domain names. Prices start at about $3 a month for up to 10 managed domains. You can also use DN Simple to register domain names, purchase SSL certificates. All of my domains have been moved off of GoDaddy and are now at DN Simple. I like it because there's an application on my iPhone. I can manage my DNS from there. There's an API that you can use. The best part, actually, is these one-click services. So you can register a domain, get it up and running in a couple of minutes, and then go in and apply services to it. So you can say, this domain is for Google Apps, and this domain is for GitHub Pages, and this domain is for Postgres. And they know the DNS records and set them up for you. Even for something as complicated as Google Apps, there's like 11 different settings you need to create. They handle it all for you. So here's the deal. They've got a special 30-day trial. You can cancel at any time, But Hansel Minutes listeners get 3 months of free DNS service. So you go to dnsimple.com/hm. Special deal for Hansel Minutes listeners. Just visit dnsimple.com/hm. Hansel Minutes listeners get 3 months of free DNS service. Love these guys. They're so nice. DN Simple, hosted DNS. Check them out. If you're putting that kind of work, though, into things like BMI and lean muscle mass and things like that, is it mostly diet? Because, like, right now, my goal is to get a six-pack before I turn 40. And I'm hearing – well, thanks for laughing. And I'm hearing that that six-packs are made in the kitchen. And it's 70% diet. And unfortunately, the diets are really boring. And I'm wondering, at the level that you're operating at, is this one of those things where you just have to eat ground turkey and peppers all day?
I have definitely had my diet called boring before. I love food and I love flavor and I do like things that are not healthy. But I also value what my diet provides me. So when I am ready to get down to business and be training and leaning out, having that kind of a boring regimen is okay with me. I know why I'm doing it. I don't have cravings. It really feeds and fuels me, and those benefits far outweigh the blandness or the non-creativity of the meal. But, mm-hmm. It's like I said, I can't do that 365 days a year. There are definitely times when I'm focused like that, and then there are definitely times when I am not.
Mm-hmm. Give me an idea, if you don't mind my asking, of what a boring diet would be, because I can take notes for myself.
Yeah, well, so for instance, one thing that I actually haven't changed in a long time is my breakfast. And my breakfast consists of oatmeal, and I have it measured. And I have a teaspoon of peanut butter in it. And sometimes I spice it up. And by that, I mean I add like mangoes, dried mangoes, or raisins, or maybe even some maple syrup sometimes. But mostly that's the base. And then I'd have 8 ounces of a protein drink and my vitamins, a multivitamin, my fish oil, and vitamin C. Mm-hmm. Absolutely need to have that. And that's my breakfast, and that will sustain me for a good part of the morning. No cravings. I feel very satiated. Mm-hmm. It gives me the energy to go climbing right after, or go running, or whatever I need to do that's active that morning.
And do you eat at the Microsoft cafeteria, or do you bring Tupperware with strange things in it?
I pack my breakfast everywhere I go. When I'm traveling, I always make sure of anything that is what I have.
Uh-huh. And lunch?
Lunch is a little trickier because I think I can find salads. I can find things that just work. So generally, I have a good salad, usually spinach salad, mm-hmm. lots of proteins like beans. I have a little bit of fat in there, so artichokes or avocado. I don't have any dressing in there. It's very lean.
Mm.
And so I can have my two meals. Right now, this is what I'm doing, two meals that are pretty well balanced, pretty lean. And then my dinners they're a little bit free-for-all. They're not completely, hamburgers and french fries or something. But I definitely do have that on occasion.
And do you calorie count, or is this more of a grams of protein type of a diet?
I've done a lot of research for myself on the calorie counts, and this diet has fallen out from that research. So I am not calorie counting at the moment. I have done that in the past. I have tracked everything that I was eating and put it into a spreadsheet and mm-hmm. marked what I was doing. I, wore a little body bug, and these are things that track your calorie output against your calorie input.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot about my eating habits. And I think just understanding what my eating habits were helped me define how I could maintain a better eating style today.
Mm.
So for instance, I used to be a feast starve eater, and I didn't know that. So what that meant was, if I felt that, and this was all like something that was happening in my head, it was a perceived notion. It wasn't actually, a true representation of what I was eating or not eating, but this is the way I perceived it.
Mm-hmm.
If I felt that I was eating too much, then you would see my calorie count go up.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I hit some perceived mark, I would say, oh gosh, I've been eating too much, so I need to pull back. So then I would just under-eat the calorie intake I was supposed to have for a day or two or three, mm-hmm. and it gradually start putting more calories back in as I started getting hungrier. And then you'd see this like, oh, well, I'm eating too little, so I'm eating a little more, and then I'm eating too much, and then now I'm starving myself again and going back up into these like highs and lows. And that's not good for consistent performance or training, and certainly not for your overall like feeling of being satiated and well-nutritioned.
See, this is very sad. You've just described my last month or two of dieting.
Yeah, so I made a change, and now I eat more consistently, a similar calorie count more regularly, and that helps me feel better.
Mm-hmm. So this is interesting because I'm hearing there's an analytics to this. I mean, it's not just show up and be awesome, and you've obviously got some genetic talent, but you have an analytical mind, and presumably that's the same kind of person that would create an Excel spreadsheet full of diet information is the same type of person that would create an Excel spreadsheet for work and do all sorts of analysis about a particular feature in Azure or something compute organized. I mean, how much do you think that your personality is making you successful at work and in your lifestyle?
I'm sure it's the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did a talk for Microsoft actually for climbing training, and in there was a diagram of a pyramidal diagram for progression, and then I followed it with some charts, and I had to laugh. Yes, I had to laugh because only a Microsoft person could appreciate that there were charts in this PowerPoint slide about climbing training.
That's awesome. The fact that there's a PowerPoint at all, as opposed
That's
to
right. yeah,
no field trip there. But it sounds like your job, and forgive me if I'm taking you in a direction that's not okay, but you're choosing to prioritize one thing over the other. Like, you could be all career focused and be at a high rank at Microsoft and, I don't know, make lots of money and, I don't know, whatever Microsoft benefits would provide you if you went kind of all out. But I'm seeing or I'm hearing that that's not your priority, and that you've got a nice, comfortable situation, a nice, comfortable position, and it enables you to do more outside of Microsoft.
That's right, actually. I'm very, very lucky, and I think very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in. And I've worked really hard to create the type of flexibility that affords me to be somewhere where I have a very different backyard for climbing, if you will.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you've got, so you're in Seattle, right?
Currently, no, I'm not in Seattle.
Where are you now? Are you traveling?
Yeah, I'm actually living in Kentucky for a few months.
Really? And so you just like called your boss, like, you know, Kentucky has some awesome rocks. Can I do my job from here?
No, it's not as simple as that, actually.
that would be great.
It would be great. There are definitely some things about my work environment that I don't promote too highly, or too broadly. The reason is that it's not as simple as that. When you work away from the office, things have to be seamless. They have to recognize you as still being basically in the office, not traipsing the world, right? Because it sounds like vacation.
Exactly.
This is by no means a vacation. I think it's very much a misunderstood idea when someone hears that I'm working remotely. Mm-hmm. I'm living in this wonderful place with this great rock behind me, but my opportunities for climbing are not as vast and bound as I would like. But for me and what I'm accomplishing and being able to hold my job, I don't care because, like I said, it's like having another backyard for me to access. And that gives me, when I have free time, I get to go out and climb on this fantastic rock that's not in Seattle and not accessible given the weather right now. Mm-hmm. But it is accessible here. So it's a unique opportunity. And I realize that it's a very rare thing and it's not common at Microsoft at all. So I try not to take advantage.
No, I understand. Well, remember, you probably don't know this about me, but I'm not in Seattle. I'm in Portland, Oregon, and I work remotely. And I've written extensively on what it means to be not visible and how often we as remote employees have to make sure that they know that we're there. I was actually, I've been at Microsoft now. This will be 5 years this month. And in a stand-up meeting recently, they were going around in a circle. Everyone was telling like what they were working on. And they did this for an hour, and we had a round table, and I had a camera and everything like that, and they hung up on me. And I emailed my boss's boss, and I was like, I never got to say what I was working on. And he said, oh, I couldn't see the camera. I forgot you were there. And I was like, oh, man. I mean, I've worked here for 5 years, dude.
That's right.
I just want to tell you what I'm working on so you don't fire me.
That's right. It's a very challenging thing to have a presence when you're not physically there, because despite the flexibility that Microsoft, says they promote, the culture is not necessarily in the same place.
Yeah, exactly.
The one benefit that I have is that my team has a development office in Shanghai, and actually my development team is in Shanghai. That causes some problems with time zone differences, especially when I'm remote and want to get in some climbing at some point and still work on Pacific time. Mm-hmm. But it works because they're used to having people who are not in the office. And so more often than not, we have our meetings are set up always online. So, and that's a different, that's different than the whole of the Azure world. This is more my big compute area.
Right. Do you think about your kind of your life goals in the sense of like, you want to get that next big promotion and move up and be a manager and get a big sack of money? Or do you think to yourself, this is a good level? Like for me, I pushed and I got a level at Microsoft, or a rank. You know, they have all these different HR levels. And I think to myself, all right, this is a good level. You know, I could be at this level forever and never get promoted again. And that's totally fine because my kids are happy and my wife's happy and I've got a good lifestyle.
Yeah, it's definitely crossed my mind. I know that Microsoft just isn't the kind of place that you can stagnate at, and that levels and career development are really important to the company. And that is a challenge. I have conversations with management about futures and potentials, and I do want to progress. I love what I do, and I like working in this company. And I do want to see myself doing well, but I'm not willing to sacrifice some things to do too well, and I don't want to set a trajectory that's too steep. So it definitely has a more plateaued effect to it, maybe more gradual slope than I would otherwise have. And that's fine for me, as long as I can continue to be rewarded for the good work I do and that I see that I'm still moving forward somewhere.
Right. But you actually left and then came back, didn't you?
I did. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that changed everything.
Was that because of climbing that you left?
Yeah, I left and I went off the road. I bought a Eurovan and lived in it for 18 months just about. Just traveled and climbed full time, no work.
That's awesome.
It was really, really good.
The thing that I don't know has become clear yet in this talk, and I'll give you the compliment, is that if I understand from everything I'm reading about you and all these numbers, you're world-class or damn near world-class at the climbing level. That's not a hobby. That's not something that you see people climbing at this level and also doing full-time jobs. Do you?
I'm actually impressed with the number of climbers that do have full-time jobs and climb really well. I do think that when you talk to athletes and you speak to climbers at that level, it is a challenge. But we, you know, maybe we're the personality types that will just do what it takes to be able to satisfy both of those needs. I don't know, but you're right. There's not that many people. There are a few of us, though.
And is it like a club? I mean, do you all know each other just from like you hear about like, oh, so-and-so did a 512C and that's crazy.
Yeah, actually, the club's online. You can go to 8a.nu and stalk us anytime.
That's cool. At some point, will you choose to plateau and you'll say, well, this is breaking my body down, or the tendons in my hands are breaking down? Or is there something that you can keep pushing until you're into your 50s or 60s?
Gosh, you know, I really hope I can keep pushing it. I really don't know where to stop right now. I've seen people who are, you know, in their 50s or even in their 60s and climbing really well. And I know a gentleman, he did another 14, and he's in his 50s. And I just admire that they can still be out there and climbing so strong and pushing their limits. Even at that age, it just shows me that there's no limits, really. It's just whatever you can think you can do and imagine and have the drive for, go for it, and it might be possible.
What kind of things will start to break down physically? Like, I assume you're putting a lot of, like, the fingers I'm thinking about. Like, I know from typing my hands hurt, and I've had tendon pops and trigger finger surgery. I can only presume that you're doing a lot to your hands.
Yeah, I think the thing that suffers the most is my computer work coupled with the climbing, because it's all forearm and arm based. But really, I think the things I notice the most are my recovery times are a lot longer. I need more rest. I can't do hard stuff, as many hard climbs maybe, or as I used to be able to do. So I have to be more efficient and selective about how I go about training to prevent injury, to stay healthy, to get stronger with, you know, the way I'm aware of my body. And that's, I think, a function of age. I think you watch the kids today and they hang on forever, never get tired. They have this strength to weight ratio that's just to die for. And as an adult, yeah. And you watch them, they can eat anything and, oh, you know, to be young again.
No, I know. I'm coming up on 30, you know, on the north end of 40 there. And I'm starting to realize that just literally the difference between 34 and 35 and 38 and 39 is just more than 5 years. It's like a decade, particularly around recovery time. You have to move smarter, which is really interesting. Well, this has been really, really cool. This is fascinating. So it's okay for people to go and check out your blog, and you have a Facebook athlete page. What was the name of the forum for learning about climbing?
8a.nu.
8a.nu.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you, Audrey Snezek, for chatting with today about climbing and the work-life balance.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.